Hey folks, welcome to Footnotes. I'm your host, Jamar Tisby, bringing news and views to help you become a more informed citizen, activist, and believer. In this episode, I recap the impeachment inquiry, including the most damning testimony yet. I explain why the president's comments comparing lynching and impeachment are grossly inappropriate. I discuss Princeton Seminary's efforts at reparations and share an inspiring story of a high school coach demonstrating disarming love. So, before we get into it, it's been a while, but we're back again. So, for the first time since we started this podcast in, I believe, June of 2019, I had to skip a week. That's because we were just getting back from the Joy and Justice Conference, and we had, well, Bo, our producer, had literally hours and hours and hours of editing to do for all of the keynotes and all of the workshops that we had during the conference. I will talk more about the Joy and Justice Conference at the end of the episode during Tisbits, but it's great to be back again. We've got a lot to cover. But as we always do about this time, reviews. You all, you're awesome. Thank you so much for listening, for tuning into this podcast, and for taking the time to leave a review. I know it takes effort, right? Like you're listening to this podcast, you're out and about or doing whatever, right? And then you take the time to pause, to click all the appropriate buttons, and to type out a thoughtful comment. So we are at 226 reviews. That is up from 206 last time I was on the mic. So thank you, thank you, thank you. This time, since we've been gone, I'm going to read two quick reviews. This first one comes from M. McNeff, and this person writes, I needed more thoughtful engagement with the culture in my life, and Jamar has a great perspective to bring light to many of the complexities that aren't mentioned in most circles. If this kind of commentary could make its way into the church at large, then we will see its trajectory aligning more closely with God's heart for his people. Thank you, Jamar. Well, thank you, E. McNeff is what it is. And we'll do one more, this one by Juliana Abraham. Often I listen twice to each episode because I need to hear such goodness at least twice. I'm so thankful for Jamar Tisby's work and voice. Thank you, Juliana. Thank you for tuning in at all, let alone twice. A double blessing, a double portion in heaven, I believe. No, I'm just kidding. But I do really, really appreciate that. And I thank all 226 of you so far who have left a review. If you haven't done it, if you want me to read yours live on the mic or at least have a chance at that, the only way that happens is if you leave a review. So go on over to Footnotes on iTunes and let me know what you think. All right, on to the news. Let's start with this minor story, the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. It's not a minor story, of course. There's no way you could have missed it if you've used the internet at all in the past 3 weeks or so. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, who had long resisted launching a formal impeachment investigation, finally did just that. And it's over the president's dealings with Ukraine. It's alleged that in a phone call that Trump had with President Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine in July, that Trump said, do me a favor, quote, do me a favor, and urged Zelensky to investigate Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, and his dealings with a Ukrainian gas company on which Hunter Biden sat on the board. So in return for this favor, the president of the United States, Trump, would release more than $400 million in military aid that Congress had already approved to the Ukraine. In other words, this is a case of quid pro quo. A whistleblower released the information that brought this exchange to light. The impeachment became official soon after that. And in the ensuing weeks, we've had an onslaught of further discoveries about this one issue. Text messages between Gordon Sondland, ambassador to the European Union, and William Taylor Jr., who is acting ambassador to Ukraine, in which Taylor texted Sondland, quote, crazy to withhold security, crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign, And in another tweet, Taylor said, it's a nightmare scenario. So here's what happened. William Taylor, who sent these text messages, he gave damning closed-door testimony about his knowledge of the president's dealings with Ukraine. This testimony alleges that this was a case of quid pro quo and that aid to Ukraine was contingent upon Zelensky publicly announcing an investigation into the son of one of Trump's strongest opponents for the 2020 election. So it must be said, lest we get lost in the news cycle here, that no evidence of wrongdoing or inappropriate actions have been found on the part of Joe or his son, Hunter Biden. Now, Biden sitting on the board of this Ukrainian company while his father was vice president, it may have been unwise, but there hasn't been any illegal activity uncovered, which is a talking point that some opponents are basically trying to hype up. They're saying, hey, there's this big conspiracy that Hunter Biden was doing something wrong and his dad, who was vice president, bailed him out. Well, that's not been at all proven. It has been debunked, as a matter of fact. But in this guy Taylor's testimony, who again is the acting ambassador to Ukraine, he did a closed-door testimony in front of Congress, which said that, I mean, in his testimony, he basically confirmed that the release of military aid to Ukraine was dependent on Ukraine making a public declaration that it would investigate Hunter Biden for interference in the 2016 election. So basically, this guy Taylor's testimony is the clearest evidence yet of a quid pro quo, which is a hard phrase to say quickly, quid pro quo, and the president's direct involvement in the proposed deal. So if you're sitting back getting lost in the daily announcements around impeachment, here's the basic way to think about it. What's clear is that the sitting president of the United States held up military aid to get a foreign country to dig up dirt on a political opponent, dirt that could possibly help him get reelected. Jennifer Rubin of the Washington Post put it this way: we have never had a president ask a foreign government to interfere in an election on his behalf and use taxpayer-funded aid to extort an ally into this breach of American sovereignty. Of course, we don't know for sure. I would imagine that this has never, ever, ever happened before, but certainly nothing this blatant in our lifetimes. Where we have a president asking for help digging up dirt on a political opponent and using foreign aid and holding it hostage in order to get his way. So even if you're a Republican, even if you support the president, this should concern you. It was not long ago that Republicans stood for patriotism. I seem to remember folks making a big stink about a certain football player kneeling during the national anthem in protest of police brutality and anti-black racism, and so many people, especially those on the political right, saying it was unpatriotic. So many of those folks had as a basic requirement that the president would look out for the interests of the United States over his own personal political fortunes, that the president would not rely on a foreign government to assist in his own reelection. But from Russian interference in the 2016 election to the dealings with Ukraine now in 2019, this is clearly a pattern with Trump. So what now? Well, Democrats will continue to subpoena witnesses over the objections of Republicans. Republicans will continue likely to cry foul. The House will eventually call a vote to impeach, and the majority Republican Senate will probably strike it down. Although, with this volume of evidence corroborating this idea of a quid pro quo, it's likely that some Republicans, even in the Senate, would dissent. I mean, I would imagine. I would at least hope. So what's a Christian to do? You know, not all that different than what any other citizen would do. Number one, keep up with the news. Like, this is really, really important stuff, that the president could be impeached. And now that these official inquiries are in motion, Congress has the ability to find documents and subpoena people, subpoena witnesses, and procure evidence that they weren't able to do so before, at least not as forcefully. So we're learning new things, and it's been very revealing so far. So keep up with the news best you can, but also pray for the president. The Bible tells us to pray for those in power. Pray that you know, he would exercise wisdom. Pray also for Congress people, that the truth would come to light beyond any partisan concerns, and that we would know the full extent of what happened for the good of the American people, for the Ukrainians, for the world at large. And pray for all of our political leaders who too often have to choose between doing what is right and doing what will get them reelected. We're at a critical moment in our nation's history. Impeachment is a huge deal. But it's there for a reason, and we're seeing more and more reason why impeachment is necessary under this president. On to our next topic. When, if ever, is it all right to compare something to lynching? On Tuesday morning, President Donald J. Trump forced us to ask a question we didn't really want to consider. Once again, the president inflamed the country through a tweet. In the midst of a very public and probing impeachment inquiry, the president posted the following message on social media. So, someday, if a Democrat becomes president and the Republicans win the House, even by a tiny margin, they can impeach the president without due process or fairness or any legal rights. Trump went on to say, all Republicans must remember what they are witnessing here, a lynching. But we will win, all caps. So, he did it. He went there. He said, all Republicans must remember what they are witnessing here, a lynching. So, if you don't already know, let me tell you why that's bad. So the Equal Justice Initiative, headquartered in Montgomery, Alabama, put out the third edition of their report, Lynching in America, Confronting the Legacy of Racial Terror. And in that, it said that the EJI has documented 4,084 racial terror lynchings in 12 southern states between the end of Reconstruction in 1877 and 1950, which is at least 800 more lynchings in these states than previously reported. EJI has also documented more than 300 racial terror lynchings in other states during this time period. So just put that in perspective, right? Nearly 5,000 cases of racial terror lynchings, most of them in the 12 states in the South, but also all over the country, between the end of the Civil War, well, really the end of Reconstruction, on up to about the time of legal desegregation. That would be the Jim Crow era. And during that era, Black women, men, and children were murdered, often on false accusations or for minor offenses and infractions. And the president used and evoked this image of lynching to talk about his impeachment. But there's more. So this is not sort of the only case of a politician talking about lynching. I know for certain that in November of 2018, Cindy Hyde Smith, who is now one of the two senators from Mississippi, she said something about lynching at a campaign rally, a fundraiser hosted by cattle rancher and a supporter of hers, Colin Hutchinson. She said of Colin, quote, if he invited me to a public hanging, I'd be on the front row. If he invited me to a public hanging, I'd be on the front row. Now, she said this in Mississippi, the state with the highest number of recorded lynchings, and a state with some of the most infamous lynchings, such as the lynching of Emmett Till in 1955. And then, folks, they doubled down on this statement. She didn't retract it or anything. She said, It's an exaggerated expression of regard. No admission of wrongdoing. It's an exaggerated expression of regard. So just take it for the linguistic thing that it is. And Governor Phil Bryant, who supported Cindy Hyde-Smith in her Senate race, said, "I know this woman and I know her heart and I knew that when I appointed her and I know it now." She meant no offense by that statement. Well, the excuses continue. So that was about Cindy Hyde-Smith's lynching comment. Again, she's a Republican too. Lindsey Graham, who was an opponent of Trump, who didn't like Trump at first, but now has become one of his most sycophantic supporters. He doubled down and defended the president and said, "This is a sham. This is a joke. This is a lynching in every sense." That's what Lindsey Graham said. "This is a lynching in every sense." Every sense? Really? Really, Lindsey Graham? This is a lynching in every sense? So this is racially motivated? This is outside of legal confines? This is physically dangerous, violent, even deadly? Yeah, no, not in any sense is this a lynching. So I said in a tweet that the president doesn't get to use the word lynching. And I say that because he doesn't understand or refuses to understand the gravity of the term. In fact, it's just the opposite. He continues to promote in various ways the very ideologies that lynch mobs acted on. So look, you know this. He has a long history of racism. He has denied black people the opportunity to rent in his apartments in the 1970s. He called for the death penalty for five black and Latino youth, known as the Central Park Five, now the Exonerated Five. And he still hasn't recanted that. He announced his presidency in 2015 by accusing Mexican immigrants of being racist, white supremacists. They've experienced a public resurgence under this presidency. We could go on and on and on. And it occurred to me in the midst of this ridiculous statement and all the energy that we reluctantly have to put into thinking about it, it occurred to me, has the president even visited the lynching memorial and the Legacy Museum in Montgomery, Alabama? You've probably heard of this. I went on opening weekend, and it is a stunning display. They have these metal columns representing each county where a lynching took place. And on those columns are the names of the people killed. These metal columns are suspended in the air. They are hanging like strange fruit. It's been said that when it rains, these rusted columns drip red, almost like blood. Nearby is the Legacy Museum, and it's centered around the phrase, "slavery evolved." And it shows the transformation from race-based chattel slavery to the crisis of mass incarceration. They show a straight line from enslaving people to incarcerating people who are disproportionately black and brown folks. So the president has visited other museums such as the New Civil Rights Museum in Jackson, Mississippi, which was controversial, and he's visited the National Museum of African American History and Culture in the nation's capital, but he hasn't yet been to the one monument dedicated specifically to lynching. Why not? I mean, it's not for lack of time. He has spent nearly a third of his presidency, over 300 days so far, at one of his several resorts, oftentimes golfing. And more to the point, his willful denial of the racist connotations of lynching are what got us in this situation of talking about a tweet in the first place. So again, why shouldn't the president use this word? Let's remember, folks, that lynchings were extrajudicial. The victims were denied due process. The lynchings happened outside of the official criminal justice system. So how is an impeachment inquiry of the president anything like this? Even if you disagree with the impeachment proceedings, this mechanism is literally written in the Constitution. It is legal. The Democrats are pursuing legal means to investigate a man who constantly self-deals and has been caught, transcripts and all, trying to gain a political advantage over his opponent by withholding aid to a foreign country. This impeachment inquiry is carried out through the approved legal channels. It's nothing like a lynching. Also, this is a distraction from the impeachment itself, which continues to reveal explosive findings like I just talked about with William Taylor's testimony. So no, the president doesn't get to use that word lynching. And this is not me trying to police language. I'm saying he hasn't earned the right to use that word by showing what it means, nor has he demonstrated in any meaningful way an understanding or empathy for the most frequent victims of lynching, black people. Lastly, just one more word on this. When something like this happens, someone misuses the term lynching, think twice before you post pictures of actual lynchings. So first of all, these are real people in those photos, image bearers of God and people who look like me, black folks. Showing these pictures just to make a point is not necessary. The people who really need to see those pictures and be horrified into changing their minds are probably not the ones looking at them. But you know who is? Black people. These photos are not abstract. They're visceral. We know that entire communities have been traumatized by lynchings and bear those scars to this day. I've been to Glendora, Mississippi, where Emmett Till was abducted from. I live 30 minutes from the Elaine massacre, where over 200 sharecroppers were killed in a white race riot. I know for a fact that those scars remain and that the trauma of those incidents is felt even a century later. So when you post those pictures, you risk re-traumatizing black people and reminding us of the long and still very present reality of our own dehumanization because of white supremacy and anti-black racism. So if you ever think about comparing something you're going through to a lynching, think again. When a seminary pays reparations. Princeton Theological Seminary in New Jersey recently announced that it would pay over $25 million in reparations in repentance for its pro-slavery past. This is from an article in NJ.com. Founded in 1812, the seminary benefited from the slave economy through investments in southern banks and from donors who profited from slavery. Its founding faculty and leaders used slave labor during their lifetime, and some advocated for sending free black men and women to Liberia, according to the seminary. The seminary's ties to slavery are part of our story, said President M. Craig Barnes. It is important to acknowledge that our founders were entangled with slavery and could not envision a fully integrated society. We do not want to shy away from the uncomfortable part of our history and the difficult conversations that revealing the truth will produce. The seminary believes the $27.6 million amount is the most any college has pledged to pay through reparations. So, number one, to be clear, this is not Princeton University. This is the seminary, and the two schools are not formally affiliated. It should also be noted that the seminary is tying this action explicitly to their Christian faith. Later on in that same article, another official at the school said, quote, "The religious context had everything to do with it. Repentance is not just about talk. It's about action." So Princeton joins other schools such as Georgetown University, whose students recently agreed to increase their own tuition in order to raise enough money to give reparation scholarships to the descendants of 272 enslaved people that the university sold to keep itself financially afloat. This is not the only move like this. But it's a big one. Like they said, this could be the biggest amount paid that in reparations from a school or a university. But this move is not without criticism. So as much as $27.6 million is, it's a tiny slice of the school's $1 billion, with a B, $1 billion endowment. So yes, $27.6 million is a lot of money, especially when there was none set aside for reparations. But in the larger scope of things, when you have an endowment that large and a sin that large, some people are saying that it's really, you know, not commensurate with the wrongdoing of the seminary. Another criticism is this: the money, a lot of that money is going to be used toward 30 new scholarships to the descendants of slaves or underrepresented groups. That the scholarship would cover full tuition plus $15,000. But here's my thing. It's often problematic to offer scholarships for Black people to attend a school that has a racist legacy. I know from an institutional standpoint, it makes sense to give out scholarships for your own school, but prospective students, be warned, you can't just jump at these scholarships. You really have to deeply consider whether this is an institution you want to attend, and furthermore, whether this is going to be a healthy environment for you, racially speaking. My thing is, if your school has a racist history and is likely still in dealing with the legacy of that racism in terms of, you know, all white boards of trustees, majority white faculty, a climate on campus that still isn't racially responsive, even if you get a scholarship, do you want to go to that school? Is that the best place for you? So here's an alternative. Why not offer scholarships, but students get to choose any seminary? So you say, okay, we're going to give you scholarship money. It's going to be restricted for seminary use, but it doesn't have to be our seminary because there could be some places that are healthier for you. I know it doesn't make sense from an institutional standpoint, but it's not about that. This is about repair. Another alternative is offer these scholarships, but offer them for students to attend historically Black seminaries, which would not only help the individual students, but it would help these Black seminaries that are always looking for more students and probably don't have a $1 billion endowment to help them out. So one more criticism, that these reparations are not just for Black people. Jamar, why is that a problem? Well, if you look online about this, you'll see some chatter around this, but the institution, the seminary officials have said that these reparations funds are going to go for students who are descendants from slaves or if they're from underrepresented groups. Those are two different groups there. So race-based chattel slavery, we'll just be straightforward here. Race-based chattel slavery focused on Black people as a race of people. Of course, other groups were oppressed, of course, but it was Black people who endured centuries of enslavement in this country. Are other groups owed some form of reparations? Maybe. But these that the seminary is putting forth are reparations for slavery. And in that case, shouldn't these resources go toward repairing the harm specifically done to Black people? I know this is going to rub some people the wrong way, but at least hear this viewpoint. That's out there, right? So why include this other group, underrepresented groups, which could mean, you know, anyone. It could be Latinos and Latinas. It could be Asian American people. It could be immigrants or refugees. It could be handicapped people, people with disabilities. It could be any LGBTQ people. It could be any number of groups that are historically underrepresented. And it's not wrong to strive for all kinds of diversity and all kinds of equity. But at the end of the day, we have to wonder if this urge to include Black descendants of enslaved people plus other underrepresented groups in reparations for slavery specifically, we have to think, is this about political correctness maybe? It would seem too radical and narrow-minded to focus exclusively on the harm done to Black people. So then institutions decide to include other underrepresented groups as a way to soften the blow. I'm not saying I have the answer or I agree with this or what have you, but this is definitely something to think about. So when it comes to reparations for slavery, it's not about other oppressed groups. It's not discussing even their right to restitution. When you're talking about reparations for slavery, it's about the unwillingness of institutions to focus on and expressly acknowledge the unique price that Black people have paid due to anti-Black racism and race-based chattel slavery. So, something to consider. But with all its drawbacks, Princeton Theological Seminary and other schools, some of them not even Christian, are going far beyond what white evangelical schools are doing. The most prominent example I can think of is the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Not long ago, they put out a close to 80-page report on slavery and racism in the history of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And they basically found a lot. And one of the findings was that the founding faculty of the school, all four of them, were deeply involved in slavery and deeply complicit in the defense of slavery. Then the report goes on to detail a horrifying history of further complicity with racism, segregation, slavery, you name it. And at the conclusion of all of this horrific history, what's the action? What's the outcome? Well, in a letter from Al Mohler, the president of the seminary, he was introducing the report in this letter, and he says, quote, "In light of the burdens of history, some schools hasten to remove names, announce plans, and declare moral superiority. That is not what I intend to do, nor do I believe that to be what the Southern Baptist Convention or our Board of Trustees would have us do." So, I do know that some scholarships are being offered to Black students. I don't know if it's a more general sort of, you know, minority students or underrepresented groups, but some scholarships are involved. But you won't even consider changing the names of buildings? They said, Mohler in his letter said, some schools hasten to remove names. So you won't even change the name on a building? Why is that? Well, if a Southern Seminary is like most other schools, then the trustees have something to do with it. He says that in that quote, he said, "Nor do I believe that to be what the Southern Baptist Convention or our Board of Trustees would have us do." So trustees can exert pressure from above on college, university, and seminary presidents. And of course, donors can mess with the money. They can withdraw their financial support and put the institution in a difficult place. So, while the Princeton Seminary effort at reparations is not perfect, it is a model for white evangelical institutions to actually put aside large sums of money in an effort to repair the harm that racism has caused. Again, with the caveat, are you going to offer scholarships to an institution that has and continues to struggle with racism? I'm not sure that's the best approach, but would that more historically white institutions, especially Christian and evangelical ones, engage in such a process of truth-telling, repentance, and repair as we're seeing from Princeton Seminary? And for our last story, maybe instead of more guards with guns in schools, we just need more coaches. So, there was stunning surveillance footage that captured the moment when a high school coach in Oregon disarmed a student with a shotgun and held him in his arms. This is from an article, and it says, Keenan Lowe, a football and track and field coach at Park Rose High School, can be seen walking through the hallways and entering a classroom on May 17th. When he next emerges, he is holding a shotgun and backing away from student Angel Granados Diaz before another teacher comes up and takes the weapon away. Then, in an extraordinary moment, Lowe, the coach, embraces Granados Diaz and the two hug for at least a minute. So, of course, people are heralding Coach Keenan as a hero. But here's what he had to say. I feel like I was put in that room for a reason. You know, the shooter didn't, he didn't know that I was in the room when he opened the door. And I think there are things in my life that have prepared me for that very moment, Lowe said. He went on to say, I thank God that no one got hurt, and I thank God I was in that room. So I tweeted this story out a couple of days ago. It's been shared almost 1,000 times. It's a great heartwarming story. You know, a few weeks ago, we were talking about another hug. This was Brant Jean, Botham Jean's brother. Botham Jean was killed by a white police officer when she mistakenly entered Botham Jean's home, thought it was hers, and shot him, thought he was an intruder, killed him. She was convicted, and then at her sentencing hearing, where she got 10 years, she'll be up for parole in 5, Botham Jean's brother, Brant Jean, said he forgave her and hugged her. And somebody called it the hug heard round the world, and I thought that was very appropriate because the thing went viral. There was this huge debate about forgiveness. I can't get into it on this episode, but I did get to write about it in the Washington Post, and I was on NPR talking about it. So if you want to hear more details, go there. I'll include a link in the show notes. Also, let's get back to this case. So this is a very heartwarming moment where this coach diffuses a situation that could have turned deadly. So the student walks in with a shotgun into a classroom at his high school, doesn't see the coach. The coach sees the student with the shotgun, grabs the shotgun, makes sure it's not pointing at the students who are now running out of the back of the class, wrestles the shotgun away from the student, and instead of hitting the student or tackling the student, what the video shows is the coach, Coach Lowe, Keenan Lowe, hugging the student. And it's a long hug. He's grabbing him, not aggressively, but it's this love that won't let you get away. At one point, the student tries to pull away, but the coach won't let him, and the kid just sort of surrenders in his arms. And it is a heart melting kind of moment of you know, this coach literally disarming a student with love. So, like I said, I tweeted the story out, but I also included this line. It could have turned deadly if it had been an armed guard and not a coach. So, one of the things I thought about as I'm viewing this really heartwarming moment is thank God that it wasn't an armed guard or a police officer assigned to the school at that moment. It could have turned deadly. This is why we had no armed guards in the schools where I worked. So, I worked in schools as a teacher and a principal for almost 10 years. In that entire time, we never had an armed guard on the premises, just kind of like there to patrol. Now our school, the couple of schools that I worked at were in, you know, territories, areas that had pretty high crime rates. Our schools had to be put on lockdown several times over the years because there was an active shooter in the area involved in crimes totally unrelated to the school, but they were nearby the school, so they put us on lockdown. But armed guards or police in schools or just generally, they're not good at de-escalating, especially if there's another gun involved. And we've seen this time and time again in videos of unarmed Black people getting shot and killed, or Black people who have guns legally and lawfully, and sometimes they even announce they have their gun legally and lawfully, still turns deadly. So they're just, I mean, these folks in general, a lot of them are just not good at de-escalating situations, especially when there are weapons involved. It could lead to a standoff and others could be killed in schools. Now, you know, don't mistake me. The rules are different for like an active shooter situation in the school. By all means, call the cops. You know, not everybody can do what Coach Keenan Lowe did, and I'm not sure that's an advisable tactic to personally wrestle away a gun from a kid, but, you know, he didn't have much time to think, and it was an imminent danger kind of situation, so he just reacted. But in general, yeah, call people who are trained to deal with clear and present danger and immediate threats. But on an everyday basis, having an armed guard in a school, I'm going to say no. So I remember personally just going to high school, and we had metal detectors on and off during my 4 years of high school. There would be police officers standing at the entrances to the school, and you know, on a normal day, you could get off the bus or out of your car, however you got to school, and walk right in there. But on the periods where there were metal detectors, and they used to use the wand, not really the walkthrough system at that point, there was a line out the door just to get into school. And did we feel safer? Oh, no. No. We never felt, or I never felt safer. I felt like I was under surveillance. I felt like I was being perceived as a criminal, and I hadn't done anything. And then throughout the day, with armed guards in the hallways, I felt like I was being watched, like they were patrolling because we were criminals or inmates or anything but students who were there to learn. So it doesn't, even apart from a violent or a tense situation, it just doesn't lead to a conducive atmosphere for learning and for education and for trust and for community building. Now, again, don't get me wrong. We had relationships with the officers who patrolled the area where our schools were. We called them in non-emergency situations. We called them in emergency situations. But having them on duty on a regular basis, that's a different story. So safety is paramount in schools. And we need officers, sometimes armed, to help us with that safety. But we have to be careful not to unnecessarily put students in harm's way by adding deadly weapons into the mix of the thousands of human interactions that take place on a daily basis in each and every school. Each of those interactions has the potential to go south. Instead, we need more Coach Keenans. People who can not only defuse a situation, and sometimes that doesn't mean physically taking a gun away, but just calming down a student who's on the verge of harming himself or others. And we need Coach Keenans who can not just de-escalate, but express love in the midst of that situation. Enough love to embrace a student for nearly a minute, to calm that student down and make sure they know that even at their worst moment, even at their worst mistake, it doesn't take away their right to humanity or their right to dignity. So good job, Coach. You gave us the off-the-field lesson of a lifetime. Now, folks, a brief tidbits, because I have to mention the Joy and Justice Conference. And I am full of joy. Even now, weeks later, we are so grateful to God for answering basically every prayer we threw up at the Lord. He came through on. Things were dicey for a long time. When I tell you this conference was a challenge to plan, that's the understatement. Such an understatement. Look, we were working remotely as a team, right? We weren't all in the same city. We were doing this over phone, over email, over text messages and Slack. And so that makes it a lot harder when you have one decision to make, which face to face, you could get through it in like 60 seconds. When you're doing it virtually, it takes like 3 days. So everything took longer. We started off late. It took us a really long time to settle on speakers, to get them to commit to say yes, et cetera, et cetera. So it was well into the 2019 year. And then we had to switch conference planners. We ended up with a fantastic conference planner. Thank you, Zena. Money was a huge deal. Man, look, a lot of people have asked me what the budget is for The Witness, and this is a podcast of The Witness. Look, we've never had enough money to really even justify a budget. So doing a conference, we had to fundraise the largest amount we've ever had by far. And really, right up until the last minute, it was dicey whether we'd be able to pay all our bills. Thank God. you know, folks came through, you listeners like you came through and really helped. So thank you deeply. And what I can tell you about the conference is, in my experience, it's rare to have a really Bible-centered, theologically rich conference that's also unabashedly Black-centered. And I say that in my circles, right? There are Black-centered conferences put on by Black churches and Black denominations, but folks like me and the people who access the witness, we inhabit these sort of liminal spaces between Black and white worlds and Black and white Christianity. So we may be people of color, but we often find ourselves in predominantly white settings, whether at work or in school or in churches. And so in those settings, it's very, very rare to find anything that's unabashedly, unapologetically Black and Black-centered. But that's what we did at the Joy and Justice Conference. So everyone who took the stage where we held the keynotes in this beautiful old historic Black church, shout out to the folks at Ebenezer Missionary Baptist Church on the South Side. And everybody who took to the stage was Black. So everyone you saw up front leading, speaking, singing, announcing, emceeing, all of that, they were Black. And that's significant because how many conferences does that happen, especially if you're used to sort of white evangelical spaces? Almost never. The other thing was, you know, the style of preaching, the style of singing was very familiar. It was in a Black cultural vernacular that felt comfortable. It felt like home. And then the speakers, they were just amazing from the keynotes to the breakout sessions. Folks delivered. They came through. They spoke truth. They spoke it passionately. They spoke it biblically. And there were so many people afterwards who just said this was exactly what they needed. I think the most poignant compliment we got afterwards was actually a week after. I was at another speaking event in a different city, and somebody there had gone to the Joy and Justice Conference. It was a young Black woman, and she came to the mic during the Q&A session and stood in front of the whole crowd assembled there and said, "Hey, I was at the Joy and Justice Conference, and I just want to say that as a young Black woman, I felt safe there. I felt comfortable." And to me, that was so meaningful, because Black women at this intersection of race and gender experience all kinds of exclusion and marginalization and oppression. So for this young lady to get up and say that she felt safe in this conference, in this environment, that she could just be herself and she wasn't on edge about who might offend or how they might dehumanize her, that meant the world to me. So thank you to everyone who came out. Thank you to everyone who donated. Thank you for folks who donated so people, other people could get there, even though the people who donated money couldn't themselves go. Thank you for everyone who prayed for the Joy and Justice Conference. So if you would like to access some of this great content that I've been raving about, go to joyandjustice.com. There is a tab in the upper right-hand corner that says digital access. Click on that button and you can purchase digital access. You can get videos of all the keynotes and audio of all the breakout sessions. If you attended Joy and Justice, then the digital access pass comes free with your purchase. So you do not have to buy it. You already got access to it when you bought the ticket to the conference. That's it for this week. Like my author page on Facebook. That's facebook.com/JamarTisby1, the number one. I'm also on Instagram at JamarTisby and Twitter, both at JamarTisby. Remember, you can contact me via email at footnotespod1@gmail.com. That's footnotespod1@gmail.com. Thanks to our production assistant, Christina Button, our award-winning producer, Bo York. Footnotes is part of the Witness Podcast Suite. Check out thewitnessbcc.com for more great content. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Jamar Tisby, and this is Footnotes.